not really in broad systemic terms, because people don't think about things in broad systemic terms.
So within the focus, if you don't mind me jumping in.
Jump in.
Within the focus group dynamic, do you therefore deal with issues of framing like you just described?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, can you go to a Democratic group and say, listen, you're blowing it. Your message is gobbledygook. You need to bumper sticker it. I mean, is that something that you're comfortable with doing and that you can do? I mean, because it's obvious. Yeah, we've been whipped on the message from day one. No is easy. And on the other hand, we've run past some stuff. 45, that Paul Begala touched on it, we've touched on it all day long, 45,000 dead Americans a year is not okay.
Right. No is easy, yes is hard, and that's part of the reason why, even though the vast majority of Americans think that our system needs, you know, major reforms, you don't have a vast majority of Americans who support the current bill. I think that there are questions of priorities. You know, if you look at the American public, the truth is that the vast majority of them have insurance. And, it's hard to get people to think a lot about, you know, changing a broad system when they themselves are insured. One of the things I don't think that we've done well enough is let people know that there's a lot for everybody here. You know, we are not only going to make insurance coverage affordable for every American, which is our moral obligation, we're going to look at the people who already have insurance but don't have any security in it, don't have any security in how they're treated by their insurance company, don't have any security in what happens to them if they lose their job, don't have any security in what happens to them if they get really sick and get their coverage dropped. And we're going to look out for them, which is every American, not just the uninsured.
Well said. Too bad that a lot of powers that be haven't explained it that well. Very well said.
We're getting there.
That's one of the things that Bob and I is bothers us so much. We mentioned it many times on the program today. We're being outshouted. We're being outtalked. The other side, the no side, has been so well organized and so well funded, and it's disconcerting to us that we don't have that kind of support.
They have been, but the other thing is that because we don't have a bill passed right now, there are a lot of distractions that they can use by focusing on the process. You know, oh, they're trying to go too fast, or oh, the bill is too long and nobody's had a chance to read it. And they can do all these things to distract people by focusing on the process. Once we pass a bill, then the focus is going to be on what's actually in it, and then our messaging is going to be sharper, and then we're going to start winning some of these battles.
Well, Jeff, it's interesting talking to you, and I have always wanted to ask somebody about that focus group deal. It's something that interests me. I see a lot of polls, and sometimes I go, where the hell did they come up with that? But there's more science to it than I thought. I thought maybe you just went out in the street and said, I need 12 people to come in here and let's have a focus group. But it's far more scientific than that.
I hope so.
Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Jeff, you got a website, of course?
We're at anzaloneresearch.com.
A-N-Z-A-L-O-N-E, research.com.
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being on. That's interesting. Interesting. I've never gotten to be part of a focus group. I've never gotten to be part of a...
You know what? I have.
You have?
Yes. It was a long, long time ago. And Agnes and I were walking through a mall in, I think, Huntington, West Virginia. And we were invited to be part of a focus group about household cleaning products.
Really?
Yeah. And you know what it was? You know what it was? It was geared toward the introduction of Clorox wipes, we later figured out.
Oh, you were on the ground floor of that. You're the one...
Without Agnes and me... there would be no Clorox wipes.
I thought maybe it might have gone back as far as Mr. Clean or Lest Oil. Lest Oil, the modern detergent.
No.
Mr. Clean.
That's you.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Well, I was there for Lysoak, Grandma's Lysoak.
Well, one of my early uses of one of those words that give people hissies, it's not you, it's someone else. I learned what Octagon soap tastes like, and Octagon soap is no longer made.
Oh.
That was that sort of honey brown laundry soap, and it did not taste good.
Did it have lye in it?
I'm sure it did.
The old lye soap, Grandma's lye soap?
Yeah, yeah.
Little Herman and Brother Sherman had some trouble washing their ears, but they washed them with Grandma's lye soap, and they haven't heard a word in years. Yeah. Okay.
Is that from your Glee Club days?
No, no, it isn't.
Not from your jingle writing days.
You don't like that?
I love it.
Grandma's lye soap. This message, this program brought to you today by Grandma's lye soap. Yes. In case you didn't get it right the first time, Little Herman and Brother Sherman had some trouble washing their ears. But they washed them with Grandma's lye soap. And they haven't heard a word in years. And there's a chorus to it, too. It's a fine song.
It must be. If it's something you've committed to memory, it can only be good.
Oh, Texas Bessie said she heard the phone, and she heard, for your information, the music earlier.
Nah, she's just making you feel better, guy.
Now, the phone, okay. But the music. Thank you, Betsy. You have...
She's just saying that to make you feel better.
No, you've got to... If Texas Betsy
there was no
said,
music.
Well, I've got proof right here that there was.
No.
And I don't...
No.
If Texas Betsy... I can understand if you're going to doubt me on it. But Texas Betsy, she's a teacher, isn't she?
She is.
She's a teacher.
But she's also a compassionate human being, and she doesn't want you thinking there are voices inside.
She wouldn't lie for me.
She's not lying. She's just making you not question.
She said she heard the music. Well, did you hear the big band music, Betsy? Did you Boogie Woogie Bugle Boys?
There was no big band music, Betsy. There just wasn't.
Benny Goodman? That's who it was.
There's no big band music on these computers. I couldn't play big band music if I wanted to.
It was coming in from someplace. It was bleeding in. It was part of that problem that LaVisa told you about. Electrical.
Receiving probably from all the black helicopters overhead last night.
There were some of those. I did hear helicopters without seeing any of them once in a while.
Fleets of black helicopters.
That's quite a sound, you know, when you're in the canyons of these tall buildings here down through the streets, and you hear that helicopter roaring up there. That's quite a sound.
Well, it was just, you know, it was amazing. And, don't come past that post. You know, like, I'm not even going to say it because they'd just carry me away. They would just put me, I brought you a snack.
A snack?
If you will look behind your monitor.
Oh, this is wonderful.
A little lemon bar and a little pecan pie bar.
Oh, that's so nice of you. I shall eat
treasure
this.
It always, yes.
I shall eat this before we go to dinner.
Why don't you? Yes.
Because I am hungry. We didn't have any breakfast.
I haven't eaten a bite. I ate one of each of those, and I have now had food today.
No breakfast, no lunch.
Nope. Oh, we've had food today. Candy has brought us candy.
Candy. Candy is dandy, but liquor is quicker.
That's right. Bless you. Bless you.
You've heard that before. Yeah. That was one of my favorites.
We'll talk about Valentine's hearts.
Yes. Thank you.
You know, we are getting treated like royalty here.
We are.
It's a delight.
But we didn't have any lunch.
No, we didn't have any lunch. We're going to make up for that.
Absolutely.
Man, this would have been the night to go to the home office.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Woof. Well, you know what? You know what it is? You know what time it is, guy?
It's about a minute and a half until...
It's time to leave.
You going
to
leave all this equipment here?
No, they won't let us. We can't have the table until 11 tomorrow.
No.
Yeah, so I gotta pack the rig. And.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll go up and freshen up while you're doing that.
Yeah, why don't you go up and freshen up while I'm packing the rig there, Zarny?
No, I'll help you. I'll help you.
Are you Carol? What? And your name is? Oh. Well, we're wrapping up the program right now.
Yeah, we got about 45 seconds.
Yeah. And we are just killing. No, 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 no. It's wonderful. We've been with you since noon today or thereabouts. And we will be back tomorrow at noon.
Where are you broadcasting?
We are broadcasting to the whole blessed world. Do please. I look forward to it. All right. Take care. We will be back at noon Eastern time here on the Horn, America's Liberal Voice. Of course, you know that. And we will be going through 5 p.m. again. Guy will be getting on the big silver bird and flying back south tomorrow.
Oh.
Yes, you will.
Oh.
Because you have to have nose on grindstone Saturday morning, if I understand correctly. And that being the case, we will be here, and everything will work smoothly and delightfully, and we've got a whole lineup of magnificent, wonderful guests for tomorrow.
Says you about the smoothly and...
It will. No, this time it... No, now all problems are solved.
You all heard that. Anyway, thanks for being here. Have you got the closing music?
What would that sound like? I don't know. Let's just put on some music and say that it's closing music.
Well, you have been listening to the Health America Conference on the Head On Radio Network with the infamous Bob Kincaid and Guy James. This has been a Head On Radio Network production.
And, yes, it has.
And you can listen to it again tonight after the Mike Malloy Show.
Yes, you can.
Yeah. So we'll see the all tomorrow.
Absolutely.
Be there.
Aloha. Bookum Dano. You've heard from the radical right.
Now all that's left is the truth. Welcome, Dan.
So you say there's a race of men in the trees. You're for Trump legislation. Thanks for calling. Wait or night for calls like these.
Conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Live from the Hyatt Regency Hotel in Washington, D.C., Health Action 2010 from Families USA. This is the Horn, and we've got a great day of conversation ahead for you. Lots of fascinating guests running by the table here. Bang, 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 bang. One right after the other, and we will get started with that here presently. I'm Bob, of course, sitting next to me, the inimitable Guy James. Wait, okay, why don't I have audio?
because I don't have my mic turned on.
It works better when you turn it on, Jack.
Now, I'd like to know which is it.
Which is what?
First, it was high in the hills of West by God, Virginia, and now it's Washington, D.C. Which is it?
Well,
I'm confused.
Well, you know, the intro is what the intro is. But, no, we are not high in the hills.
I'm
beautiful, almost level West by God, Virginia.
Almost. All right. All right. So we got that cleared up. It's a great day. Cold.
Yeah, it was okay yesterday. It's gotten brutal out there.
Oh, yes.
Nasty.
Yes.
Sharp-toothed wind. Scott in Sweden will promptly be making fun of us for complaining about the Washington, D.C. cold. But that's okay. You know, if you've never been to the Head On Radio Network chat room, there's no better time than right here, right now. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom. The registration is easy and free. Jump in and join the conversation, some of the hijinks as we enjoy the full multimedia panoply of this experience here at the Help Action 2010 National Grassroots Meeting brought about by Families USA. And that's familiesusa.org, right? Yes.
Yes. Well, forget that.
What?
The meal last night.
Uh-huh.
you knew we'd get around to it. I thought we might have better get
we
it
We did
out
well
right.
for ourselves last night.
Yes, we're getting good at it.
We are getting good at this. You know, the nice thing is I still maintain that little restaurant is the best bargain in D.C.
I believe it is. I believe it is.
Afterwards Cafe back behind Kramer's Books.
A landmark here in D.C.
And for good reason. Yeah. What a perfect, you know, from my standpoint, what a perfect combination, books and food.
You know, oh, it doesn't get any better than that unless you had some, you know, good blended whiskey in on it or something.
Or unblended.
Rye whiskey. Yeah. You know.
He's been singing that for a while now. Yeah. But we do have a big day ahead now. Guy will be coming along with his half of the program long about 3 p.m. Eastern time. He will be bailing out a little bit early because he has to catch the last plane out of Casablanca for Lisbon. I mean, out of Washington, D.C. for Fort Myers. We're anticipating crappy elastic weather to hit Washington, D.C. Later tonight, but Friday traffic and so forth. Guy will be bailing out, and I'll be finishing the program.
And this is no place to get marooned with hotels like at $300 a night and all that. You don't want to get marooned in D.C.
You most assuredly do not. And what's more, tomorrow morning I'll be getting up and driving up to Pennsylvania, where Rick Smith, our colleague, will be broadcasting live from the Pennsylvania Progressive Conference. And there's something about going north with snow on the horizon into central Pennsylvania at the end of January that just has me, I don't know, I don't want to get caught in the Groundhog Day loop. I'm not Bill Murray. I'm not set up for this.
Talked to somebody in Ohio about 20 minutes ago, north central Ohio, and they're getting blasted with ice right now.
Oh, ice, lovely, better than snow. Oh, joy. Well, before things do fire up and the guests do start coming our way, which may be momentarily, I want to send a shout out, if I may please, to our friends down in western Raleigh County, West Virginia. They've made it all the way up onto the page at thinkprogress.org. It is 8 days now that dedicated civilly disobedient protesters have stopped in its tracks the blasting on Coal River Mountain. Now, of course, we all understand that clean coal is a dirty lie. And the blasting has had to stop on Coal River Mountain in western Raleigh County, West Virginia, as activists have taken to the trees, and a tree sit persists in its eighth day.
All right.
In this kind of weather, that is pure
heroism. Oh, man, that heroism is exactly the word.
And just so you'll know what they're facing, the thugs from Massey Energy have been blasting air horns at them.
Thugs?
Thugs. Pure
from Massey?
Yes.
No.
Yes. Have been blasting air horns at them at a decibel rate far in excess of anything permitted under employment safety, OSHA-type regulations. They have threatened, in this weather, they have threatened to spray them with freezing water.
Well, but wait a minute.
Now, these people are 60 feet up in trees.
In West Virginia, isn't Massey exempt from all laws?
They'd like to think that they are.
It seems that they are.
They are persisting, and they are stopping this blasting, and they are doing everything in their power to preserve the last intact mountain in that region that would support renewable, green, sustainable energy in the form of the Coal River Mountain Wind Project, Coal River Wind Project, wind farm that is slated or has been proposed for that hill. So that takes a lot of courage. And frankly, if Massey thought they could get away with it, yeah, they would. They would do something awful.
They've already done a lot of awful. Sue me. I don't care. They are a bunch of conniving thugs that have their way with the good people of West Virginia. I do know how they get away with it. But
yeah, it's called money. Yeah, it is. It really is, and it's very sad. But by the same token, you know, the living proof here this morning of people power. This story at thinkprogress.org noting that yesterday in Washington, D.C., Senator John Kerry exhorted citizens to, quote, get angry about the fact that they're being killed and our planet is being injured by what's happening on a daily basis by the way we provide our power and our fuel. Well, there is no doubt whatsoever but that the reality is that the very heart and soul of the debate over how we get our energy and where it comes from is happening on the ground in southern West Virginia. So to the protesters in the trees, our undying admiration, and to the folks supporting them as well. And just keep them in your thoughts, because they're not up there for themselves. They're not up there to aggrandize themselves. They are literally up there for everyone who values the prospect of saving what is left of Appalachia from the... And, you know, the thing about mountaintop removal is it has nothing to do whatsoever with energy. It has nothing to do with jobs. It has everything in the world to do with profit, Guy. And the last Monday when I was in that meeting with the governor of the state of West Virginia, and he said, and this is a quote, in West Virginia, every job is a precious job. Well, you know what? You can't square that with human life. And the fact of the matter is, if you say that every job is a precious job, then you are by definition saying that not all lives are precious lives, because this comes at a terrible, terrible, terrible cost.
Terrible cost. You know, you must be related to a guy I knew one time. He was a head of the Timken Roller Bearing Company in Ohio, and there was a terrible blizzard coming, and it was a life-threatening blizzard, and the law enforcement officials told them to evacuate their plants and get everybody home because people might die. And his answer was, people would die without their jobs. We'll keep them open. And people did die and get marooned in the plants and all that. So, yeah.
Well, it's very interesting that out of this story in West Virginia, Governor Joe Manchin, who swore the other day that no violence would be tolerated, met with some folks from Climate Ground Zero, which is the organization that's doing the tree sit, and asked the activists there to scale down their campaign. You know, we've asked Joe Manchin to help us a million times, and he's never done a thing. But he can ask. Yeah, right.
Well, that's just regular folks from West Virginia. I mean, why would you cater to them? The coal companies are important, and you're just regular people, Bob. I don't think. When are you going to get that through your head?
Oh, I know. We're just silly people.
Man. Yes.
And by the way, Joe Manchin, after the meeting with us early in the week, he then turned around and issued a symbolic resolution that he asked legislators to sign on to, condemning cap and trade legislation.
Oh. politician, ever the politician. Indeed. We've got a lot of politicians here today. They're all over the place. We've got activists all over the place here, mostly healthcare people. We've had some people in that weren't healthcare people. It's amazing how many people show up at these events wanting to promote their cause that weren't even invited. Just come walking in the door and say, I know you've got media here today, and could I get on your program? Could I get on your show and promote my issue?
Right.
Many. In fact, I've got a couple guests this afternoon scheduled that are walk-ins.
So, oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What topic?
Healthcare, drugs. They're prescription drugs. One of them's husband, as I understand it, committed suicide a week after starting to take Zoloft, and things like that. So, you know, there are many millions of stories across the country about healthcare issues. I have a story myself. You know, I have. Got caught this past year, and I know I haven't talked about it.
No, I begged you to.
Yeah, $72,000 worth of medical bills, and you know, to try and get back into the insurance pool is impossible. Pre-existing conditions and all that.
You're one great big no thank you at this point.
Pretty much freeze you out. They freeze you out, and there's nothing you can do. You can't get insurance at any price. Sometimes, it's a bizarre. I don't know. The more I think about it, and you know where I live, there are many people from other countries that have health care. Many Canadians, many French, many English visit the area where I live, and you tell them these stories, and they just look at you like, "No, you're lying. You're embellishing this story. This can't possibly be." They do. They. Not in this country.
Well, and then the whole world over that has some sort of reasonable and rational health care program for all their citizens just stares at us guy in some sort of abject mouth agape horror to realize that the American people, for the sake of corporate profit, are left flapping in the breeze when they get sick. And the thing is, there's so much... There are so many different approaches to this problem in terms of the problems it creates. If you consider, you know, it's not just the uninsured problem. It's not just the problem of the 45,000 verified people who die every year for want of access to coverage. It's people who think that they are covered. You know, they've got health care through their employer. But lo and behold, someone has a heart attack or there's a bout with cancer, and the next thing you know, they're absolutely devastated, eaten alive by their copay, eaten alive by 20% of the bill. And there, you know, there's accounting the shenanigans that go on there, because all of these health care providers strike their own separate peace with the insurance companies, and the insurance companies never pay the same amount as what it says on the bill.
No.
So, you know, just to use nice round numbers, let's say your medical bill is $1,000 and you've got an 80-20 policy. That would mean, theoretically, that the insurance company pays $800 and you pay $200, right?
Doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't work that way, because the insurance companies cut their own deal whereby they pay, you know, maybe they pay $575, maybe they pay $6. But the hospital still comes after you for that same $200.
Exactly.
So, in essence, the insurance company is not fulfilling its contractual obligations. It is not paying 80% of the bill. It's paying less than 80% of the bill, and you wind up paying in excess of 20% of the bill.
Well, and the problem I have with the legislation they're trying to push through right now is it has not addressed cost at all.
Not as far as I can tell, no.
No. And so we're talking about, well, don't worry about it. You've got subsidies. There's going to be subsidies. Okay, if your insurance bill is $1,000 a month and you're getting a $300 subsidy, that makes it $700 a month out of your pocket. Well, the costs are just rising faster than the subsidy you're getting. So you're still in the same boat. I can't see it's addressed costs whatsoever. And for my money, that's numero uno.
And of course, our buddy Scott in Sweden says, "Wow, Bob, that's so damn sleazy. It's one big extortion scheme."
It is.
Yes, it is. The system as it now stands is nothing but an upward transfer of wealth to our corporate betters.
That's exactly what it is.
And you know, I can tie everything into this these days, but the fact of the matter is, the decision a week ago yesterday, the Citizens United decision, was just a bald-faced reminder that we don't count corporations do.
Absolutely, it couldn't have been more clear.
And it's absolutely sickening. But the fact of the matter is, the corporations have driven this debate largely, and it's thanks to the concerted efforts of organizations like Families USA that there has been injected into this discussion some element of the a very fundamental human quality of what this problem really represents.
You know, this is not a corporate problem. This is a people problem. This is a Main Street problem. This is a problem that takes place, that is dealt with and discussed and wept over at dining room tables in homes all across America. You referenced what you've been through, and it's been a living hell. I know that. We've had private conversations. You've not, and you've been hesitant to talk about it, and so much so, and that's part of the problem, Guy. I'm not getting after you, but the fact of the matter is, America goes through these things, and that same reticence you feel is felt family after family after family, because they feel like it's their problem, that it somehow brands them as being deficient or somehow failed in the process. They haven't. The system, the process has failed them. But because we're not putting those human stories out there, the human stories aren't getting heard. I was in the little room where they've got, you know, noshes and the snacks and so forth, you know, where I brought you the...
Where?
They're right over there, where I brought you the little...
Oh,
little
there's nothing over there now.
No, not yet, but there will be. They'll have more of those little lemon bars and so forth.
What I found on the internet.
And, but there was a brochure there about, I guess there's a project out there to gather the human stories that come out of this nightmare. Hey, Candy. Yeah.
Bob's getting an update here on his schedule coming up right now.
Our first interview.
You know, Bob, going back to what you're saying, it's so true. You're made to feel like a second-class sleazeball if you have something happen like I did. People say such things to you. Well, you know, you were irresponsible. You didn't have the proper insurance. No, I had good insurance. Good insurance. It broke me anyway. That's why people don't talk about it.
Dr. Hill, it's a pleasure to meet you, sir. Bob Kincaid. Oh, no worries. We've just been discussing the larger issues surrounding the healthcare nightmare in America, and so no worries at all. I'm very pleased that you could join us behind the microphone. We will be talking momentarily with Dr. Hugh Hill. He holds an MD and a JD degree. And he is he's an instructor, and he's director of the Fast Track at Bayview Medical Center. He's got 28 years under his belt in emergency medicine. And I have a feeling that Dr. Hill, I have a feeling that you have seen just about every horror story that the medical care system, as we have it in America, has to offer. Have you not?
Sorry, that helps if I turn the microphone on.
Works
Thank
a
you.
Lot better that way.
Yeah, it tends to. Just about have seen everything possible over a long career, but new things come up all the time. I just left a conference at Hopkins this morning where the emergency department was discussing a recent case that came in of a cobra bite and how to handle it.
In the United
that.
States?
Yes. A lady had it as a pet.
You know, there are wounds and there are self-inflicted wounds, doctor, but it's the kind of thing that you have to deal with in emergency medicine. Let me just jump right in there and ask, is part of the crisis in emergency medicine in this country the fact that the system is so broken that many people use it for primary care?
It's fewer than you think. It's a significant problem. We've looked at the numbers on people that get admitted and how sick they are and try to retrospectively review and analyze the complaints they come in with it. A lot of folks come in, they need to get evaluated, they need to get worked up because they've got complaints or symptoms that could be potentially serious. So the fact that they don't get admitted doesn't mean that they did not need to be there. There are some that use the emergency department as a resource and in the way that you're talking about. We're proud to serve as the last safety net in the sequence in the United States, but we do get hit hard with that sort of thing. So we're very aware of it. I think that's why most of my colleagues are very much in favor of health reform.
And that is what you have experienced thus far, that there is a significant upsurge of favorability toward health reform within the emergency medicine community?
Yes, sir. I'd say about two-thirds of emergency physicians in informal polls tend to even favor single-payer plans. They're so unhappy about their inability to take care of their patients in the emergency department or get follow-up for them.
Well, I can't imagine any other field in which there is more of a sense of urgency than obviously an emergency medicine situation. How much of a role does sweating the details of what treatment is available, what treatment would be approved, that sort of thing, play in an ER doc's treatment protocols in a crisis situation?
The emergency medicine community is involved heavily in those protocols, in working with their hospitals for what drugs and services are available on their formularies. So it's important to us. In the healthcare reform area, one of the things that's critically important to us is availability of specialists. And we need reform in part to be able to get specialists to come and help us take care of our cases in the emergency department. And that's been an increasing problem in the United States, and both of the two healthcare reform bills make a stab at addressing that.
And when we talk about reform, has become sort of a ubiquitous term in the last year or so. What is it within the emergency medicine specialty that you most want to see taken care of, most want to see addressed?
I can answer that, even though I'm not a spokesman for the American College of Emergency Physicians, I can answer that clearly and with great confidence. We very much want to see the uninsured get covered. Now, we're talking about access because we've learned that there can be factitial coverage. You can have a piece of paper that gives you insurance, but it says you can only go to the emergency room when the moon is blue and after you've stood on your head three times. So we want people to have access to emergency care in the United States. We want emergency medical services to continue to be available for people in the United States. There are other things in the bills that are important to us, but that is the core of it. If we come away from this discussion with that, a lot of us, myself included, will be doing a victory dance.
And I will join you in it. There are, as it stands now, there are laws, and you see the postings inside an emergency room, that you know you have the right to be, and is the it's that issue of stabilization, that you have the right to be stabilized and then sent elsewhere. What, as it currently stands, what's the real meaning of that?
This stems, Bob, from some laws that were changed as far back as in the 70s. When the well-to-do suburban carpeted hospitals were dumping, quote-unquote, their patients on the urban charity hospitals or the teaching hospitals. So a federal law was passed. Back then it was part of COBRA, the Consolidated Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act, and it was carved out of that and given its own name subsequently, and it still is law, called the Emergency Medicine Transportation and Active Labor Act. Basically says that what we're inclined to do culturally and want to do anyway is now a matter of law and a matter of right. When you come to the emergency room, we have to stabilize any unstable condition before you can be discharged or transferred. Under certain circumstances, you can be transferred to stabilize it, but those are the rules. Situations have come up. The first lawsuit that came up on Runtala was a woman who was in labor, and the obstetrician didn't want to come in to see her in the emergency department in Texas, and she was sent on down the road and had a problem that resulted from that. In Talavaya, it's a complaint-driven system. People complain about whether or not they were stabilized, and the federal government sends out inspectors, usually state inspectors, and they go through hospitals' records in great detail to try to find out if that's actually being done. So that's the law now.
Well, in the last couple of years, I remember, just by virtue of keeping up with current events and so forth, I remember a couple of high-profile things happening out in California and so forth, that as it currently stands, there are still issues of patient dumping that remain an issue in this country. Does the reform as it's contemplated bring that closer to a close?
Some of the issues, perhaps, because if the services are more available, there'll be less of an incentive to move patients around or to dump. However, some of them not. For example, if you don't mind my getting into the weeds a little bit.
No, please.
There's a classic split in the circuits right now. Three of the circuit courts of appeal in the federal judicial system have said that the regulation, which, well, they said it first, that the EMTALA obligation to stabilize ends once the patient's been admitted. One circuit, I believe it's the Sixth Circuit, says no. The plain language of the statute says that the hospital still has an obligation to keep the patient there until they're stabilized. So this gets into a real catfight about what happens when the patient is discharged. Does federal law apply if you want to bring a suit, or does state law apply? And that may be taken up by the Supreme Court this term in an effort to try to decide between those two opinions.
Well, you do hold an MD and a JD as well.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I kind of get into this stuff.
No, trust me. I had a cup of coffee in law school, and it's real easy to... go ahead, Guy.
I'm sorry. He's the second person I've ever met that's had an MD and a JD. I assume the MD came first.
Yes, sir, Mr. James. That's why I'm a nice guy.
I know another guy over in Columbus, Ohio. His name is Jerry Malone. And I don't know if you know him or not, but he explained to me one time in a long conversation why he got the JD. Would you mind explaining to me and our audience why you got the JD?
It's a little embarrassing. I was a child of the 60s, and we were thinking in terms of, when I went to medical school, how we can help.
If I could be so rude to tell our audience, in case you don't understand what we're saying, he's a doctor and a lawyer.
Yes.
Right. Thank you for clarifying that. As a child of the 60s, when I got into medical school in the 70s, we were thinking in terms of how we could help and fix things on a large scale. So I went to law school with that intention, to try to achieve improved health for the body politic by using the law in that way. I attended the University of Virginia, and when I graduated in 79, I'd gotten a whole education in a lot of different things, including the risks of social policy change through the law. I got to see how some of the unintended consequences can hurt. So that was very helpful.
That's pretty much the same as my friend Malone, Dr. Malone and Attorney Malone said. He saw so much that he had to do something about it, and getting his JD was a way to do it.
And what does your friend, Mr. Dr. Malone, practice?
He practices malpractice law.
I will tell you that that's unusual. There were two large RAND Corporation studies done about 20 years apart of the MD-JDs, the doctor lawyers in the United States. Both of them came up with about the same result, that most of us gravitate to medicine. A big majority of us that do exclusively one or the other do medicine. Even though the financial rewards are greater on the law side, for some reason we like taking care of patients.
Okay.
Well, let me ask then, Doctor, if I may. We hear a lot from the right wing. There's a steady drumbeat of, oh, if only we could prevent those nasty, nasty butchered patients from suing for malpractice, everything would be sunshine and daisies in this country. I take it that you have some level of experience that says otherwise?
The desire on the part of all physicians, including emergency physicians, for tort reform is real. I acknowledge, as I think most of my colleagues do, that there are real problems that need to be addressed. But I got to tell you, the malpractice system is not a good policing system. It's irrational. It gives irrational results. A couple of large studies have been done that may not be able to be repeated anywhere in the near future that showed that the only thing that positively correlated with an outcome in favor of plaintiffs in malpractice suits was severity of injury, not whether or not there had actually been an error or not, but whether or not there had been a big injury. It's highly accepted amongst physicians that oftentimes the people who we would say should be sued aren't, and the people who shouldn't be sued are. And the irrationality of the system has some consequences for patients. I think, and my own opinion is, that we need to change the focus of the discussion a little bit. We need to not be worried about whether malpractice lawyers are making too much money. We need to not be worried about whether doctors are feeling hassled or strained. What we need to do is talk about patients and the body politic and what's right and what's good for them.
And in leading into that, part and parcel, I think, of that discussion, you mentioned a couple of minutes ago the philosophical split between whether or not issues relating to patient dumping should be taken care of on a state level or on a federal level. By the same token, rates for physician malpractice insurance are set on a state level. If you spread that out nationally, does that alleviate some of the problem?
Anytime you can, yes, let me be blunt about that. Yes, some of the problem. Anytime you can spread out the risk pool and average it out, one of the theories of basic theories of insurance is that you create an economic efficiency by doing that. So it helps. But state insurance commissioners are right now tearing their hair out at the possibility of that sort of thing being done because they're trying to figure out how they could fulfill their responsibilities in regulating the insurance industries in their own states.
Is this would it be beneficial, do you think, in terms of, because, you know, as it stands, I'm a single-payer advocate. That's what I want. By the same token, if somebody wants to go out, I don't want to eliminate necessarily health insurance, private health insurance from the spectrum. If somebody wants to go out and pay for lousy coverage, you know, welcome to the market and caveat emptor as far as I'm concerned. But would we be better off with the federal government exercising supremacy over insurance law rather than having 51 or however many various and sundry state insurance commissioners?
I see it on two sides. I can see that the regularity, data collection, effort at cost control would be enhanced by federal control. I also see you lose something in having states as labs. Right now, we have the opportunity for the different states to experiment with solutions, and we see how it works, and then we decide if we want to apply it on a national basis. Right now, we're seeing what happened in Massachusetts with their health care reform. What we're seeing right there is a big jump in visits to the emergency departments and a recognition that, whoops, we don't have enough primary care providers to take care of all of these newly covered people. And that's been a lesson. So big changes, big risks, big efficiencies, but plus minus.
May I ask you, and you're the first person I've had a real opportunity to inquire about this. There is a bit of a bottleneck in terms of our medical education in this country. We constantly hear that we are in a nursing crisis, and that goes beyond nursing. It includes physician's assistants, certified nursing assistants, the entire infrastructure there. But we also have a physician crisis. I come from a very rural area. In terms of physicians willing to go and work in rural areas, is there an administrative or institutional problem within the way that we admit people to medical school and the way that we train up and bring more doctors into the system and online?
I'd agree with you on the latter two points. As to the admissions process, it's a little tougher. How do you predict who's going to be altruistic? How do you predict in the application process where a physician's going to go? On the margins, you can say it's more likely that some kids from your rural areas of the country are going to continue in that vein and go back, but it's certainly not an absolute. Primary care is obviously where we're going to need some beefing up of resources. Right now, specialty education in the residencies are paid for out of the Medicare budget in large part. Grants are given to hospitals and to teaching hospitals to pay for residencies. We could change that on a dime and start putting more money into primary care specialties and less into the primary care and less into the subspecialties and the more abstract forms of medicine.
Is there any sort of a stranglehold or what? I hate to use a phrase like that, but as far as within the accreditation process for medical schools, how many students are permitted to be admitted in a given year? Is there a certain amount of turf protection going on?
Schools have the opportunity to admit what they will. Starting of new schools is an issue. You're not old enough, obviously, to remember Jimmy Carter's era.
And, I wish.
The Secretary of HHS and President Carter believed in a simple economic approach will bring down the cost of health care by increasing the supply. So lots of new medical schools were opened. The floodgates were opened to bring in foreign medical graduates through a new fifth pathway. And we got a big jump in the number of doctors in the country. And as my dean warned my graduating class, I don't think that's going to make a big difference. And he was right. It didn't. More doctors meant more health care, more expenditures. It didn't mean competition and bringing prices down.
And did it mean it probably also meant that many of those doctors went into the more lucrative specialties?
Quite a few of them. A portion of them went into primary care. But that was almost a cultural issue. I'd like to return, if we could, to those days when the very best and brightest people in my graduating class were very excited about going into family practice. It was highly desired.
Even though they could have made
more money in ophthalmology or plastic surgery.
Well, I grew up in Alabama, and my memory is of a family practitioner that remained. You know, I've got him in that same warm category of memory with my second grade teacher and my fifth grade teacher and the people who really, really made a difference in my life. Now when I go to the doc, I never see a doctor. I see a physician's assistant. I never see a physician.
And I hope that we retain the opportunity for you to see a physician in whatever comes out on the other side of healthcare reform. But thank you for sharing that memory. It makes me feel warm, too.
Well, Dr. Hill, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure meeting you, and I look forward to perhaps talking again some other day.
Thank you, Mr. Kincaid, for the opportunity.
Take care.
Sorry.
Oh, no worries, no worries.
Thank you for that. Was great bunch of questions.
Oh, I love this. I love these conferences are just magic, the conversations that happen. And we will be joined presently by Ellen Marie Whelan. She is Associate Director of Health Policy and a Senior Health Policy Analyst at American Progress. I have a feeling this is going to be another... these are all magnificent conversations because there is a level of candor that's happening in this room that's really... And being someone who works on via the telephone most of the time, I've got to tell you that there's something very... just a moment. We are joined now by Christian Weller. He is the senior fellow, Dr. Weller is, at American Progress. He's also an associate professor of public policy at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Dr. Weller, again, thank you very kindly
for
joining
us.
I realize there's a certain harem scarum quality to all of this.
But it makes it fun.
Well, it makes it fun, and also I think it makes for bringing out information that might not otherwise bubble to the surface. I don't mean that someone's going to say something inappropriate or incorrect, but the pressure of getting to all these tables makes sure that there's a lot of information that comes out. Now, obviously, you've made a trip down from Boston, and you are with American Progress as well. Within your status as a fellow, I take it you deal with issues of retirement income security, macroecon. Money and banking, international finance, that's all out of your bio. I'm just reading. I'm cheating here. I'm not a numbers guy. I'm not a math guy. That's all scary stuff to me. My retirement plan is playing the lottery on Wednesdays and Saturdays. What does healthcare reform mean to working Americans trying to provide for their retirement?
For working Americans, both working and providing for the families, but also planning for retirement, comprehensive healthcare reform is a necessity. We do need more health insurance coverage, and we need more predictability on the cost of healthcare and health insurance, so that people can actually plan for the future. The thing is, if you don't have health insurance, or even if you have health insurance, you always have the shadow hanging over your head. If something goes wrong, you're going to lose your house, you're going to lose your college savings, you have to move in with your children or your parents, you have to file for bankruptcy.
It's a whole bundle of swords.
There's
of
a whole
bundle.
And so what it does is it prevents you from actually properly planning, both at the individual level, at the family level, but it also prevents you from, as a small business owner, to plan, because you don't know what the health premiums are going to be next year. This year they went up 5%. Next year they may go up by 28% again. And that way you can't plan. You can't plan for how many people you're going to hire. You can't plan you're going to add another store to your outlets, and so on and so forth. So for families who are trying to create opportunities for themselves and for their families, healthcare is one of the biggest obstacles to really, like, plan for the future and have a sensible approach. And so healthcare reform is a necessity in order for people to get ahead.
Well, I see that you've also studied in Europe, so I would trust that you have some degree of familiarity with the system there. How far ahead of the curve is Europe as opposed to the United States in how we deal with issues of both health care and retirement?
Well, let's say, like, the Europeans are not lining up to imitate the American system. We have by far the most wasteful health care system. There are certainly some people who get really good health care, but that is a minority.
And there are people who get really, really rich.
That's absolutely right. And what we have is, essentially, you look at the aggregate numbers, we have a system that is the most costly in the world and is by far producing not necessarily the best outcomes. We have long waiting lines. I'll give you an example from somebody in my family diagnosed with a neurological problem. It has taken us a year at this point, and this is a person with health insurance, with good health insurance. It has taken us a year to get a diagnosis. That is not health care. That is just Band-Aids, that's patches, that's nothing.
That same circumstance be different under a European, a German, a French?
It is. If you look at all the studies, most of the European systems are better in providing, especially specialist care. The wait lines are a lot less for specialist care. It doesn't matter whether you look at France, England, or Germany, even within the nationalized healthcare systems, and that's truly only just in the UK context. You look at Germany, it has a lot more choice. Once you have health insurance, you can pretty much go to any doctor you want. And the wait lines are a lot less.
I'm going to ask a simplistic Pollyanna-ish question, I suppose, Dr. Weller, but why can't we have that?
Well, we're not going to import wholesale the European or any a European style system. We can have more bang for our buck, and that is we need more transparency, better information sharing between different parts of the healthcare system so that services don't get duplicated. People don't have to wait because somebody gets a PET scan for the third or fourth time in their brain. That is unnecessary, and so information technology, reducing a lot of inefficiencies, is certainly one way of streamlining the system. Getting health insurance coverage to everybody is important. We have universal health care. If you have an emergency, you're going to go to an emergency room and you're going to get health care. So it's not a question about having universal health care or not in the United States. We have universal health care for all intents and purposes. We just don't have universal health insurance coverage.
We don't have universal payment.
And the problem with that is that people who get sick who don't have health insurance or who don't have adequate health insurance wait too long, the costs rise. There's a lot of these inefficiencies built.
There's no wellness on the front end.
There's no wellness. There's no attention for that. Clearly, Germany has gone too far on the wellness side in the past, but there are other countries who do a lot more on the prevention side, especially the Nordic countries, that seem to be working fairly well. And that helps to reduce costs in the long run. It streamlines the system by making sure that you don't wait till the last minute and then have a real emergency care.
Well, our broadcast is global because it's Internet-based. And at this point in time in our chat room, we've got a fellow, a longtime listener who lives in Sweden, who has written to me time and again about, they have discussions there about the American healthcare system, and people just are horrified. It's like some sort of barbarity that we have here in the United States when they consider it.
Well, the Europeans overstate a little bit of what is going on in the United States because for them it means if you don't have health insurance, you don't get health care. Again, if you have an emergency, you're going to go to the health care system.
But only to the extent that you're stabilized. It's not long-term.
Right, and it's not like the doctor will then run your credit card through first to see whether you can actually pay for this.
Right, it's
a problem in the system. But the problem here is it prevents people from actually getting good preventive care, good ongoing care, especially if they're chronic illnesses like diabetes. They have to wait till there is a heart attack or a foot needs to be amputated before they see health care. That's incredibly wasteful. It's barbaric in many ways. And it wastes a lot of money and energy.
Well, let me ask you this, and Candy told me to kind of keep things moving quickly, but let me ask you this from an economic or a family portfolio standpoint, what have you. Why is that business is there a real threat to the coverage in working families that do have coverages from this alleged Cadillac plan taxation scheme? Rising costs, rising into the threshold that suddenly subject people who are otherwise middle income to confiscatory taxation?
The answer is no. I mean, the biggest threat right now to anybody who has health insurance, especially good health insurance coverage, is from the current system. Because we have so much waste and so much such high cost increases, employers are increasing the cutting back on the services that they provide under the health insurance plan. They're increasing the payments to the patients. And we see continuously dropping coverage, especially in the private sector. So that's actually the current situation is probably the biggest threat, especially to people who have good health insurance. A good comprehensive reform will mean that you increase coverage and you pay for this. But the other part is also you're going to reduce healthcare inflation. You're going to make the costs go up a lot less than they have in the system. That means the employers can actually much more easily afford the plans that you're already in.
I'm thinking in terms of like self-administered union health care plans, where as costs go up and premiums go up, it pushes them into that Cadillac plan range where they maybe aren't now, but suddenly they find themselves
but
taxed.
You talk to union officers behind closed doors off the record, and they will tell you, we have no idea how we're ever going to pay for this for the next few years. There's only so many wages their members can give up to get those plans. The problem is, if you're a small local and you have 500 members, you can't change the entire United States healthcare system by yourself. And so the cost increases that the system faces will be passed on to you as a self-administered health plan. And ultimately, you just throw up your hands and say, like, look, we have to give up. We have to stop doing this. And you talk to union members in these plans or union leaders, and they say, like, there is an end in sight. Within the next few years, we won't be able to offer those plans. That is a much bigger threat than the healthcare reform. The healthcare reform is actually going to make it much easier for you to maintain those plans, because it makes the cost, it reduces the cost increases and makes them much more predictable.
Okay. Well, that actually answers a lot of questions that I've had along the way, because there's a lot of fear out there, Dr. Weller, about what's going to happen to the Cadillac plan taxation is generated, I would say, has generated as much or more pushback on the part of the progressive community, the liberal community, than any other element of the program.
I used to be a union officer. I'm a union member. I talk to union leaders. I think the part of the discussion overlooks that the current system is unsustainable and is broken. And if you don't fix it, you're going to lose health insurance coverage, especially
Let me ask you, because that sounds quite apocalyptic, and I don't use that term critically. How far are we, is there a way of estimating, how far are we from an outright collapse of our health insurance system?
Well, there's always going to be some sort of health insurance. I mean, even the poorest countries, some rich people have health insurance and have health care coverage. The problem is, I think we're going to have some sort of health care and health insurance always there. The question is, are we really getting the best bang for the buck, or are we paying a lot and still people will die too early? We have too many infant deaths, we have too many chronic illnesses that go untreated, those kinds of things, and those things will raise. And the thing is, with chronic illnesses, we're not going to see a lot of diabetes patients all of a sudden rallying at the steps of the Capitol because they're too sick and often have to deal with their diseases rather than the political engagement.
It's a hard reality.
But it is a hard reality. And that's, I think, in the end, what you're looking at is we're having this creeping problem that diseases don't get treated, that preventable deaths are not prevented. And I think we're going to see more of that when that really reaches a crisis proportion where you can't do anything but act. I think it's going to be decades away. In the meantime, a lot of people.
In the meantime, 45,000 people die a year, according to the Harvard study, and
a lot of people die with preventable deaths, die too early, or live, quite frankly, in very uncomfortable circumstances, and could have very good quality of life, and could be very productive members of their families and society.
Well, obviously, you want to see this happen. I want to see this happen. I would prefer it sooner rather than later. Dr. Weller, what would you gauge, if you were an odds-making man, what would you gauge as the likelihood of this happening in the next few months?
I think we're going to get some sort of healthcare reform. It would be my odds are that we were going to get something. There's two things here. One is the Republicans now have 41 seats in the Senate. That means they can't just simply say, like, this is all on the Democrats. They have to ultimately engage in the political process with Democrats on getting something done. The other part is one of the lessons that we supposedly have learned from the Scott Brown victory is that people, voters, care about the long-term structural deficits. You cannot talk about addressing the long-term structural deficits without talking about how you're going to reduce healthcare inflation in the long run. Those two things, because it's the biggest part in the long run of government spending, is on the healthcare side.
I guess one last question. How do we see, you and I are having a rather in-depth conversation here. How do we distill that conversation in such a way that folks can understand that they're facing having their future ruined absent this?
I think part of it is to highlight, quite frankly, how broken the existing system is. The other part is to treat people like adults. This is a complex issue. People do know it is complex. I think explaining to them that what the alternative is if there's no reform versus what a good reform would do for them personally is important. But I don't think voters and the population in general wants to hear buzzwords. I think they want to be treated like adults and want to be treated like responsible adults and engage in a conversation with their lawmakers. And I think in the end, that means you need to explain it in layman's terms as much as possible, but engage with people rather than trying to have these buzzwords of, like, socialism versus complete ruin. I mean, that's not going to convince one person one way or the other. Most people I encounter are thoughtful, interested in learning more about it and understanding the consequences of healthcare reform versus the consequences of doing nothing.
But these buzzwords are what have stopped us in our tracks, Dr. Weller.
I'm not sure that that's right. I think the town hall meetings, the Tea Party stuff is overblown. Those are people who, extremists in many ways, and they exist on both sides, who will not be convinced one way or the other. I think there's a large middle of smart, thoughtful people who you can engage, and you need to tell them, like, look, this is a huge problem. And it is a complex problem, and it requires a complex solution. And explain to them that there is no silver bullet.
Okay. Well, Dr. Weller, thank you very kindly, and I wish you the best as you go forward in this effort. We need these conversations, and all I can hope is that more of them take place, and that they do so, you know, beyond the confines of this conference.
I think they're happening, and I think Mr. Scott Brown heard a lot of those conversations when he was in Massachusetts on the campaign trail. I think so. I mean, Massachusetts is a slightly different ballgame because 97% of people have health insurance in Massachusetts. So, but people are worried about possibly losing what they have, and they're clearly worried about the cost increases. So, and you look at some of the statements that Senator-elect Brown has made, it's clear that he is worried about sensible solutions and engaging truly in a bipartisan manner. And let's hope that stays like this when he comes to Washington.
I hope so. Christian Weller, Senior Fellow at American Progress, thank you very kindly,
and I wish you the best
as you work your way around Radio Row.
Thank you very much, Weller.
Take care. There are elements of this discussion that there are layers upon layers upon layers upon layers And one of the nice things about being here is that, as opposed to, you know, you and I mostly work by telephone, Guy, and this is an opportunity to look people in the eye and judge credibility and make a real connection to the issues at hand.
Agreed. It's always better to look somebody in the eye and assess where they're coming from and their sincerity and so forth. And we have a lot of really great guests here. And, you know, Bob, one of the things about coming to one of these events is, like, yesterday, I was thrilled to have Paul Begala on. I mean, everybody knows who Paul Begala is, but some of the people, like...
You know, I was jealous.
Oh, well. But some of the people, like you just talked to, people don't know their names. They don't know who they are. They don't know the importance of their work, what they've done behind the scenes, the research, and, you know, both people you've had on today so far. Nobody knows their names. But a lot of them are the unsung heroes of this whole healthcare movement, and
that do the skull sweat.
They do, and they are unsung, and they don't get a lot of credit and all. But they're the people that have built the foundation for where we're at right now, and worked it for years and years and years. And by the way, yesterday you set out to get us something to drink.
Mm-hmm.
You came back with nothing for quite a while.
First time. Oh, you scored.
I go out to...
Yeah, we're engaged. Oh, this is the front end of some Guy James self-aggrandizement. The man just brought me lunch, and it's a beautiful thing.
Yes.
I don't know when I'm going to get to eat it.
Well, go right ahead.
I don't know. I never know when the next guest is going to wander by.
Well, you can stuff your face until they do come by.
That's a beautiful potato salad. Red potato salad.
Very, very good. Very nice.
A lovely pickle.
I had to have somebody help carry everything back here. Because
you know, we are pickle-eating fiends at the Kincaid, the Kincaid Mansion.
Oh, me too.
Virginia. I can bring, you know, those big old gallon-and-a-half-size jars of whole dill pickles? I brought one of those in the other day. It was gone in a day and a half.
Yeah, I love good pickles, too. Really do. At a little impasse here right now. Quite a few people broadcasting programs. Of course, I think you probably mentioned our friend Tom's right next to us here today. How many do you count? 10 or so?
About 9.
9 doing shows. He's Bob's very busy getting lunch. And I don't know when we have another guest scheduled here. I'm going to take a look at Bob's.
Any moment now. I mean, Candy told me to keep it rolling.
Oh, yeah, she's got quite a few in here for you. Let's see, what time is it? It's 1 o'clock. 1:05, you've got Ann Dunkelberg. And I don't know if you found her bio yet or not. Oh, you've got it out. You're ready.
I've got everything in order.
Oh.
That's about as close to obsessive compulsive as I get.
Incredible. I unfortunately get very close to the edge of that a lot.
So, could you go, I don't know, go ask Candy perhaps if we can get our next guest in here? And
I'll just yell over there.
No, let's not do that. These are sensitive microphones and sensitive computer speakers out there.
Didn't stop that guy from screaming while I was interviewing Begala yesterday.
Yeah, but we're better than that.
I don't know why they do that in a radio row. I mean, they got controls on their...
I know.
I'll go sacrifice and see where this guest is.
Go take one for the team.
At great peril to myself.
I got to tell you, this is some fabulous potato salad. I never eat on the air. This is terrible. I feel like such a radio Philistine. But it is awfully tasty, and I really appreciate Guy bringing it along, because I didn't know there was lunch yesterday, but, yeah, nice sandwich, nice pickle. Got a little cookie going on there. Mm, yeah. Happy, happy. I think we have our next guest making her way toward the podium. Hi, Bob Kincaid. Ann, pleased to meet you. We are joined right on time, I might add. Right on time by Ann Dunkelberg. She is an expert in policy and budget issues, I am told, by cheating and reviewing your biography. You are a consumer advocate,
Correct.
And but you come to D.C. from Texas, where you worked in you were program director for acute care in the Texas Medicaid Director's Office. And with no insult intended, I would imagine if you have seen Medicaid in Texas, you've seen your fair share of nightmare stories.
Well, frankly, most of the nightmare stories come from people who are trying to get on or stay on Medicaid. The people who get on the program are generally pretty happy with it.
Well, that's what I mean. It's the struggle to, and you know, whether it's Alabama Stan or Mississippi Stan, the struggle to get that coverage, especially, frankly. And I was born and raised in Alabama, so understand I'm not standing on the outside criticizing in. But it's getting into the system that makes it so confounded difficult.
Absolutely.
And there are people who fall by the wayside. There are people who are fall through the cracks. There are people, I mean, and we use these euphemisms. There are people who die for want not of access to coverage. I've talked a lot, and the audience is probably sick and tired of hearing it, but that I sat down and I read the Harvard study.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that we lose, you know, they say we lost 55,000 people in Vietnam. We lost 55,000 soldiers killed outright in Vietnam from somewhere around 1963 to 1975. We lose 10,000 short of that every year in this country. Not because their diseases can't be treated, but because they do not have access to health care coverage. Tell me, please, with all that past being prologue, tell me, please, can a publicly crafted solution like the expansion of Medicaid take a bite out of that 45,000 death number? If this reform passed.
Absolutely. And, you know, Medicaid is just a piece of a much bigger picture. When Texas, as some of your listeners may know, we have the worst uninsured rate in the country. You know, we're the second largest state in terms of population. We have the worst uninsured rate in the country, with 6.1 million Texans being uninsured. And that's a third of our adults. One third of working age adults are uninsured in Texas. Medicaid is just a piece of the solution there. We estimate that under either the House or the Senate bill that we're looking at right now, that somewhere between 1 million and 1.3 million adults would gain Medicaid eligibility for the first time in Texas. And in addition to that, we hope that we would bring in another 400 to 500,000 children who are eligible for Medicaid in Texas right now, already, without any kind of changes or reforms, but aren't enrolled just because our eligibility systems are in such bad shape. So Medicaid can be a huge piece of the solution. It is not the whole solution. One of the things I like to say about the need for health care reform is that there's sort of two things going on. One is you need for everybody to be able to get health insurance at an average price so you don't have all these wild and unfair price variations. And then you need a big solution for the millions of people, working people, whose incomes are not enough for them to afford health insurance even at the current average fair price. And so that's where Medicaid comes.